It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we journey outward from the Earth in our solar system to the latest findings of probes investigating three planets. Later in the hour, the really big ones, Jupiter and Saturn, will be discussed. Bill Kurth of the University of Iowa will be here to talk about those planets. First of all, we're going to start out with Mars, fairly close, the fourth planet. We are the third, of course, the Earth, and Jasper Halicus is with us, Associate Professor of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Iowa, co-investigator for NASA's MAVEN mission to Mars. Jasper Halicus, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Ben. It's a pleasure.
You are instrument lead for one of the experiments on board MAVEN, the Solar Wind Ion Analyzer. But first of all, reacquaint us with MAVEN's mission.
Absolutely. So MAVEN is really trying to figure out what the heck happened to Mars. When we look at pictures of Mars's surface today, we see abundant evidence that there may have once been a lot of water on Mars, a substantial atmosphere. We see things that look like rivers, things that look like lakes, perhaps even oceans. But when we look at Mars today, we don't see any evidence that there's still a lot of atmosphere and water there. In fact, it's cold and dry. There's only about 0.5% of the atmosphere on the surface that there is on the Earth. It is colder even than it is today in Iowa on the surface of Mars, so really not a pleasant place to be. How did we get from point A to point B? Mm-hmm. There's two possible answers, essentially. All that atmosphere and all that water could have gone down into the surface, into the rocks, or it could have gone away into space. On MAVEN, we're investigating that second possibility, trying to find out whether the atmosphere of Mars could have been stripped away into space.
Mm-hmm. So what are you finding with the data, also from your instrument, the Solar Wind Ion Analyzer?
Well, what we're finding is that it appears that a lot of the atmosphere did, in fact, escape into space. We're seeing loss of atmosphere even today at a significant level. If you extrapolate that back in time, we believe what we're seeing is that a substantial fraction of the atmosphere of Mars was, in fact, stripped away into space by the energy from the sun.
Mm-hmm. So what is, describe, what is atmosphere anyway? Well, the Earth has an atmosphere that protects us from a lot of things and helps life here on Earth. Otherwise, we would not be here, right?
That's correct. If we didn't have atmosphere to breathe, we wouldn't last long on the surface of this planet. If we didn't have atmosphere to protect us from cosmic radiation, we mm-hmm. also wouldn't last long on the surface of this planet.
Mm-hmm. So atmosphere is layers of what?
Atmosphere is layers of gas. On Mars and Earth, that gas is slightly different. On Earth, we've got a lot of nitrogen, a fair amount of oxygen, a little bit of carbon dioxide. When you go to Mars, things look a little bit different, at least in present day. It's mostly carbon dioxide on Mars now, which we would not be able to breathe very well, I can tell you.
Mm-hmm. So the idea is that Mars, how long ago did Mars have a lot of water?
Somewhere between 4 billion and 3.5 billion years ago. So it's been quite a while. We're talking early in the solar system when there was substantial bodies of water flowing around. There may have been periodic episodes in the climate where there was a little bit of water on the surface. But, large volumes of standing and flowing water were probably only there very early in the solar system.
Join our conversation as we discuss the solar system, three planets in particular. Jasper Halicus with us, a co-investigator for NASA's MAVEN mission, talking about Mars. Later we'll talk about Saturn and Jupiter with Bill Kurth. Join our conversation. Your questions, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. So, talk a little bit more about what you see, and I see it's called the hydrogen cycle on Mars. And this hydrogen cycle is not holding on to the hydrogen.
That's right, yeah. What we have been seeing over the past couple of years, we've been at Mars now for about 2 Earth years, or in fact about 1 Mars year. There's about a 2-to-1 ratio there. And what we're seeing is that the hydrogen is highly variable over that time scale. Now, why is hydrogen interesting? Well, hydrogen's interesting because it's part of water. Every water molecule has 2 hydrogens and an oxygen. So when we see hydrogen escaping from Mars, what it's really telling us about is what's happening to the water in the atmosphere. So it's a very important species to look at.
Mm-hmm. So when we picture the Martian year, it is the fourth planet. It's out quite a bit farther than we are from the sun, and its orbit is also an elliptical orbit like the Earth's?
That's correct. And in fact, Mars's orbit is even a little bit more elliptical than the Earth. So when you talk about Mars seasons, it has the same seasons that the Earth does. If you were, for instance, in the southern hemisphere, it would have a summer and a winter. But there's an additional effect, which is that Mars is sometimes closer to the sun and sometimes farther away. And what we're seeing is that when it's closer to the sun, there's more hydrogen escaping. When it's farther away, there's less. That's not too surprising, but what's surprising is that we're seeing that the number changes by about a factor of 10. So it's as if you had a pot of soup on the stove and you just had it at a nice little gentle simmer and you just touch the knob a little bit and suddenly it's boiling over.
And it's when it's closer to the sun that it loses the most hydrogen.
That's exactly right, yeah. So though the amount of energy from the sun is only going up by about 50% when you're at closest approach to the sun, that's enough to tip you over into this boiling situation where there's lots of hydrogen boiling off.
And the hydrogen is going off where? Just into space?
It's going off into space. It's forming a cloud that's expanding out into the universe. It's never coming back.
Mm-hmm. So you said it was surprising that this is such a variance in the rate at which the hydrogen is being lost. Why is that surprising?
Well, what's surprising is just how variable it is. If you just look at how much energy is coming in from the sun, you might guess that that would translate to how much the atmosphere is heating up and how much of the hydrogen is being liberated to space. If you guessed that that was a linear variation, you might guess that there might be about a 50% variation. We're seeing a factor of 10 variation, so that means that there's something very nonlinear in the system. Somehow you're tweaking the knob just a little bit and things are going crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So what we believe is happening actually is that there's circulation in the lower atmosphere that's important. There are big dust storms that are bringing water up to higher altitudes, and that water is then getting broken up and the hydrogen is being released.
Mm-hmm. So the MAVEN mission will continue on the orbit. A second Martian year will be experienced here by this probe, the MAVEN probe. So what questions do you think you can answer in the second time around that you didn't answer in the first?
Well, as anybody who's been through a couple of Iowa winters knows, things can look pretty different from year to year. Not every year looks the same. You know, on average, it's warmer in the summer and colder in the winter. You can expect that to hold pretty well. But imagine the difference in Iowa for a polar vortex year versus a non-polar vortex year. The number of, days that you can't send your kids to school is going to be dramatically different.
Right, right. So your instrument, your instrument lead for one of the experiments, the Solar Wind Ion Analyzer, what does that do?
The Solar Wind Ion Analyzer was designed to measure the solar wind, which is a stream of ionized particles coming from the sun at about 1 million miles per hour. So that's one of the energy inputs to the system. This is one of the ways that the energy from the sun impacts Mars and eventually translates into escape.
Mm-hmm.
What we've also discovered is that this instrument is really good at measuring the escaping hydrogen. So this is a bonus piece of science that we didn't know we were going to get going in, but we've figured out a clever way to use the instrument to measure the byproducts of this hydrogen and infer when it's escaping.
Mm-hmm. What other instruments are aboard that spacecraft?
There's about 9 instruments on the spacecraft. You can think of them as kind of being the different senses of the spacecraft. So there are noses, there are eyes, we're touching, we're tasting, we're seeing the escaping atmosphere. My instrument, Swaya, if you like, is one of the noses, one of the instruments that's directly measuring particles. But we also have ears, which are hearing waves. You'll hear about similar instruments later from Bill Kurth. And we have instruments which are like eyes, which are taking pictures of the atmosphere.
And this, the launch date for this mission was, when was it on Earth and left the Earth?
MAVEN left the Earth in late 2013, around Thanksgiving time, if I recall correctly, because it was my son's birthday. Mm-hmm. And it took about 10 months to get to Mars, so it arrived in Mars September of 2014. So it's been there just a little over 2 Earth years now, or a Mars year.
Mm-hmm. And so far, has all the technology functioned as expected with all the instruments as well?
We've been a remarkably successful mission so far in that we haven't had much go wrong. The spacecraft is functioning great. The instruments are all working exactly as we expected and in some cases even doing better than we expected.
And that instrument that you're the lead on was actually built here in Iowa.
It actually was not built here in Iowa. It was built at the University of California, okay. Berkeley, but it's currently operated here, and we have a team of scientists analyzing the data.
Mm-hmm. What does that look like when the data comes in? What is actually the data you're getting? Anything that mere mortals can understand?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the raw data when it comes in is a bunch of ones and zeros that no one can understand. But we quickly translate that into a series of parameters, which are things like the density and velocity of hydrogen atoms. So we're measuring how many hydrogen atoms there are, what direction they're going, and how fast they're going.
Mm-hmm. And you receive this data on a daily basis, a weekly basis, in packages, or... Is it a constant flow, for instance?
We get it twice a week. So twice a week, the spacecraft turns its antenna towards the Earth and downloads data to the Deep Space Network. And that Deep Space Network is collected by the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and eventually all those bits wind their way to us.
Mm-hmm. Even when MAVA sends out some data, it takes a few minutes. How long does it take to get to reach us here at Earth?
Depends on what part of the year we're at, actually, in fact, because it depends on how far apart Earth and Mars are, and that varies by a factor of 4 or 5 over a year, so that varies dramatically. Sometimes it's 10 minutes, sometimes it's almost an hour.
Okay, interesting. Jasper Halicus is my guest, Associate Professor of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Iowa, co-investigator for NASA's MAVEN mission. He's giving us an update on that. He's also instrument lead for one of the experiments aboard MAVEN, the Solar Wind Ion Analyzer. If you have any questions about our solar system or Mars in particular, Jasper's your man. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Back in October, you, Jasper Halicus, won an Exceptional Scientific Achievement Medal from NASA for exceptional contributions to MAVEN's science using the Solar Wind Ion Analyzer instrument. It's a prestigious NASA medal awarded for exceptional contributions toward achievement of a NASA mission, and only 7 exceptional scientific achievement medals were awarded in all of 2016, and you have one of those. Congratulations.
Thank you, Ben. I appreciate that.
How much of a surprise was this?
It was a complete surprise. I had no idea it was coming. I was actually on a telephone conference with some other members of the team, and it was mentioned in passing, and I thought that I must have misheard. I quickly fired off an email saying, what's this all about? What are you talking about? I didn't win an award.
Uh-huh. And does this honor change anything about your work? Does it make your work get more noticed, for instance?
Well, it's certainly a nice line to put on my resume. Ultimately, we'll have to see whether it changes my career in any way. So far, it mostly just makes me embarrassed because, you know, I'm one of about 100 science team members on the MAVEN science team, and everyone is doing wonderful work, and my work would not exist in a vacuum without all this other great work that's going on. So mostly I just feel embarrassed about it.
All right. Jasper Halicus is with us, astrophysicist. Also joining us now, Bill Kurth is with us as well, joining us by phone from California. Bill has been on our program before, research scientist in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Iowa. Bill, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Great to have you with us again. You are lead co-investigator for the Juno Waves instrument. This is investigating Jupiter, and you also have involvement with Cassini. That is investigating Saturn. You're joining us from San Francisco, where you're attending a week-long American Geophysical Union meeting. Tell us about that, first of all.
Yes, well, it's a very large meeting. There's over 20,000 scientists here talking about all a broad range of science from volcanoes and ocean science, and space science like Jasper and I practice. I will be giving a talk on Tuesday about some of the results we're getting back from our Juno instrument.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk about, should we talk about Juno first? Remind us, what is the Juno mission about here?
Juno is a mission that arrived at Jupiter on July 4th of this year. And it's the first spacecraft to go into polar orbit over Jupiter. There's been a number of spacecraft that have visited the Jovian system, even been in orbit, but none of them have actually gone over the poles. And for me, this is very exciting because we actually get to fly over the brightest auroras in the solar system. And furthermore, we get to fly through the regions that we think are essential to delivering the charged particles to those auroras. The charged particles that hit the atmosphere of Jupiter cause those atoms to glow.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just a very exciting mission to be part of.
How long does it take Juno to complete an orbit?
Right now we're in orbits that are 53 and a half days long.
Mm-hmm. And so what are the most exciting things you found out the Juno mission has discovered recently?
Well, from my point of view, I'm very excited about studying the auroras and the processes that go on along with those. One of those are some radio missions. We call them auroral radio missions. They range in frequency from maybe 10 kilohertz to 40 megahertz. And these are some of the brightest planetary radio missions in the solar system. In fact, the earliest radio astronomers studied Jupiter as one of their very first radio sources way back in the 1950s. And just by studying the frequencies that they could detect from Jupiter, we learned an awful lot about the planet. We learned, for example, that Jupiter has a very strong magnetic field. And we also found that the length of a day on Jupiter is about 9 hours, 55 minutes. This is something that's hard to do for a gas giant because all you see are clouds, and it's hard to tell what the deep interior of the planet is doing in terms of rotation. So,
So the outstanding questions at this point from your point of view about Jupiter are?
Well, we believe we understand the mechanism for producing similar radio missions at Earth in conjunction with Earth's aurora. This theory has been around for a number of years, but we've never applied it to Jupiter in the sense that we could actually go there, measure the energetic particles that are driving the auroras, measure the radio waves that are being generated, and see if the theory that seems to work reasonably well at Earth actually applies at Jupiter.
Mm-hmm.
If it does, it's very good for astrophysicists because Jupiter is the closest thing to an astrophysical environment that we have in our solar system. And
What do you mean by that?
Well, it's just a superlative in virtually every sense of the word. Jupiter has 70% of the mass of the solar system other than the sun. Its magnetic field is 20 times stronger than the Earth. The auroras are hundreds of times brighter. And so when we think about astrophysical sources, we think about very large magnetic fields. We think about very high energies. And Jupiter's about the closest we can get and go and, as Jasper says, touch and smell and feel and hear what's going on in that environment. And so it gives us another extension to our laboratory of understanding how these processes work in vicinities, environments other than our own here at Earth.
You just joined us. Bill Kurth is with us of the University of Iowa. He's a research scientist in the Department of Physics and Astronomy. Let's talk before our break about Cassini. Remind us about that mission. Now, we move from the fifth planet out from the sun to the sixth, Saturn, the ringed planet.
Yes, and Cassini is kind of a veteran. It arrived in orbit at Saturn in 2004 in the summer, and that was after about a seven-year journey from the Earth. It takes a long time to get that far from the Earth. So we've been in orbit for almost 13 years, and the mission will come to a very definitive end on September 15th of next year when we put the spacecraft into Saturn's atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. Now, so it will crash in, it'll burn up in the atmosphere.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, why do you choose to do that, or is there no choice here?
Well, we don't really have a choice. NASA has an Office of Planetary Protection, which tells us that we have to do this. And the primary reason that we have to do this is there are icy moons in the Saturnian system, Enceladus being the primary one, where Cassini has discovered that there are active geysers going on. They're spewing out water and ice. And we now believe that there is liquid water beneath the icy crust of Enceladus. And those who would like to go elsewhere in the solar system to find out if life originated someplace other than Earth, they think about places that have liquid water because, as we all know, liquid water is very important for at least the life that we understand. So if you can imagine going there in 10 or 20 or 30 years with a spacecraft that's designed to look for life at Enceladus, if Cassini would have, by accident or by design, crashed into Enceladus and we found life 20 or 30 years later, how would we answer the question of whether some microbe happened to survive its journey on Cassini and the crash on Enceladus and then was the source for life that was eventually found at Enceladus, if that's the case?
Mm-hmm.
So we basically want to make sure that places like Enceladus are pristine so that when we do go and look for evidence for life, we can rule out the possibility that life came from Earth.
On Cassini, what is your involvement with Cassini?
Well, I'm the principal investigator for the radio and plasma wave science instrument. And as Jasper has mentioned, we're kind of the ears of the spacecraft. We listened for naturally occurring radio waves from frequencies as low as 2 hertz, that's below the audio frequency range, to frequencies as high as 16 megahertz. And just as an example, one of the things that we've been studying at Saturn is the occurrence of thunderstorms. The Iowa instrument on Cassini is sensitive to radio emissions that are generated by lightning.
Mm-hmm. Bill, please hang on. We're going to have to take a short break, and we have some sound, I believe, that you provided us with lightning and thunder, actually, on Saturn. So we'll listen to that when we come back. Bill Kurth of the University of Iowa, also Jasper Halicus, two astrophysicists talking about probes in the solar system. Join us with your questions, 1-866-780-9100. Back in just a minute with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, journeying out from the Earth to look at planets under investigation by probes sent out at various times from the Earth, talking about Mars with Jasper Halicus of the University of Iowa, the MAVEN mission that he is involved with of NASA. Also talking about Saturn and the Cassini mission to Saturn, a probe around there, and Jupiter's. We're talking about the Juno mission to Jupiter. If you have a question or a comment for either or both of our two astrophysicists, please join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. That toll-free number once again, 866-780-9100. When we had to take a break, we're talking about Bill Kurth. You're talking about some thunderstorms. I understand that we used to believe that the Earth was the only planet that had thunderstorms?
Yes, actually it was a University of Iowa instrument on the Voyager 1 spacecraft that discovered that there was also lightning at Jupiter. We detected a type of radio emission from those from lightning strokes at Jupiter. About the same time, the camera on Voyager took a picture of the dark side of Jupiter and noticed clouds that were being illuminated from below by lightning flashes. So up until 1979, Earth was the only planet that we knew that had lightning.
Okay. And so we have a little bit of audio to go along with this. This is on Saturn, I believe. You know this audio you provided to us. Well, what will we hear here in just a moment?
Well, I think most of your listeners have probably tried to listen to the Cubs during a thunderstorm in the middle of the summer on AM radio and have been frustrated by a nearby thunderstorm that provides what most of us talk about as static.
Mm-hmm.
But all that noise that's interfering with what they're trying to listen to are actually radio emissions from the lightning strokes themselves. In addition to producing the light that we see as flashes, a broad spectrum of electromagnetic energy, including radio waves going down to just a few kilohertz, is emitted with each lightning stroke. At Saturn, we're seeing the very high frequency end of that spectrum when there's lightning in thunderstorms at Saturn. And these, again, were discovered by the Voyager spacecraft when it flew by in the early 1980s. But Cassini has been in orbit for over 10 years now and has been able to study the occurrence of thunderstorms in Saturn. And it's quite interesting. We typically only see one or two storms at Saturn at a time, and there may be months in between when there's absolutely no lightning going on. And in late 2010, we detected the beginning of a storm which eventually encircled the entire planet and was producing lightning at the rate of 10 strokes per second, which is about the fastest that we could count. And this produced what astronomers had noticed in previous years as a great white storm. One of these storms occurs about once every Saturn year, and on Saturn it takes 29 years to go around the sun.
Wow. And so, you said this storm stretched around the entire planet.
Right.
Okay, so the sound we're going to hear is what?
Okay, the sound you're going to hear are actual measurements from our instrument on Cassini. Now, we've sped up the time. This is actually, these data were taken over a two-hour time period, I believe. But I think you'll hear the similarity between what you hear on your AM radio in the middle of a thunderstorm and what Cassini detects from Saturn's lightning.
Okay, this is an audio representation of what lightning sounds like on Saturn. Okay, there you have it, about 2 hours condensed into 20 seconds. What is the significance of discovering that and discovering that thunderstorms happen on Saturn?
Well, I think part of all of planetary science is going to other planets and finding out what phenomena are common amongst the planets. And which ones are not. I think we learn an awful lot about our own weather and our own climate by going to other planets that have that are further from the sun, that have shorter days, that have very thick atmospheres, to find out, you know, do the same physics apply at Saturn as applies in our own atmosphere. And this is just one aspect of the type of broadening of our knowledge of our own situation by going elsewhere and finding out, well, you know, are we the only ones that have lightning? No, we are definitely not the only ones that have lightning. It looks like it's a very common phenomenon, at least in the solar system.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you've furnished us with some other sounds here. I have what is titled some eerie Saturn radio emissions. Tell us what we're going to hear now.
Well, I mentioned the radio emissions that Juno is going to study at Jupiter that are produced as part of the process that produces the auroras on Jupiter. Saturn is very similar in the sense that it has northern lights, northern and southern lights, auroras, and that the auroral process also produces radio emissions. It turns out the Saturnian auroral radio emission spectrum is very similar to the one at Earth, both in intensity and in frequency. These radio waves extend typically from about 100 kilohertz to several hundred kilohertz. And what we've done with Cassini is actually measure the waveforms coming from these radio emissions. Again, we've compressed them in time. Clearly, we the human ear cannot hear waves in the frequency range of a few hundred kilohertz. So we've basically downshifted the frequency so you can hear what these sound like. And I think you'll find that these radio emissions are very interesting to listen to. This particular one, I think, would be a great thing to have out in your yard on Halloween as the kids come to your door trick-or-treating.
Okay, let's listen to it. Some radio emissions collected by Cassini from Saturn. Let's have a listen.
Would be running for cover long before the end of that clip.
That was terrifying. Bill, very, very interesting. So by measuring the radio emissions there, in this case in Saturn, comparing them with the Earth, we find out, similar to thunderstorms, what things are universal, what do we learn when we compare those?
Well, again, it's the universality of the physics. We believe the generation mechanism for these radio waves are similar to the ones that are in operation at Earth and Jupiter. We've actually had one opportunity on Cassini to fly through the source of these radio emissions, and between now and the end of the Cassini mission, we think we'll have a chance to fly through more times. The other audio clip that I think you have ready to play there is another example of these same radio emissions, but I think you'll find that they're distinctly different. And perhaps you could play that, and I can talk about what's interesting about these particular ones.
Okay, another variation, more radio emissions from Saturn raised into our ability to hear them. Bill, what was that?
Well, that's, I think, a good example of what nonlinear physics does for you. I think Jasper was talking about the idea that you might think that the solar wind input to Mars's atmosphere acts in a linear sense. That is, you increase the amplitude a little bit, and what comes out increases a little bit. These radio emissions that are generated along with planetary aurora are an instability that's highly nonlinear, and the fact that you can generate those very narrow band emissions and the three sweeping tones that you heard at the end seemed like they were triggered by another lower frequency tone. This is evidence that there's extremely complex physics going on. I think we don't fully understand how the details of this physics works to produce these very distinct and rapidly changing radio emissions. And it's part of the reason we go to the planets is to find out, okay, we see and hear things like that at Earth. Is that a common thing, or is it strictly related to something that goes on at Earth? And it turns out it's a fairly common phenomenon, again, like lightning.
Bill Kurth is with us. If you've just joined us, research scientist in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Iowa. Jasper Halikas also here, associate professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Iowa. Each of them connected with different planets. Bill connected with Jupiter through Juno, the probe, and the Cassini and probe for Saturn. Before we move on to some questions about the future, well, let's talk about Cassini's future. You already said that the Cassini mission will end in September of 2017. It will plunge into and burn up in the planet's atmosphere, to this done intentionally to prevent it from possibly contaminating any of, I suppose, the moons there. For future missions. Tell us, it will begin a new series of orbits, Cassini. What are these last, the finale, what are they all about?
Well, actually, on November 30th, we changed the orbit of Cassini to such that its closest approach to Saturn is just outside the main ring system of Saturn. In fact, we call them the F-ring orbits because there's a tiny ring just outside the main ring system that is very complex. It sometimes looks like it has five strands that are braided, and other times it has kinks in it. It's a very interesting place. The spacecraft will be passing Saturn just beyond that ring. Between now, in fact, the first of those close flybys was on December 4th. And we had another one just yesterday. And so approximately every week we'll be completing one of those orbits until we get to late April. And then on April 23rd, we'll use a gravitational assist from Saturn's moon Titan to take the closest approach of our orbit from outside the ring system to inside the ring system. So we'll be threading the needle between the upper part of Saturn's atmosphere and the lower part of the ring system. That part of the ring is called the D-ring. And we think there's a region that may be 1,500 or 2,000 miles wide where we'll be above the cloud tops and not subjected to atmospheric drag from the atmosphere and not susceptible to running into the material in the D-ring. And that'll be a very exciting part of the mission because we'll actually get to fly through a region where no spacecraft has gone before. There's all sorts of phenomenon. We'll be flying right over the cloud tops. If there should be lightning going on, we'll be able to measure the lightning from close range. There are people who believe there are interactions between the planet and the rings, such as features in the rings that have periodicities that are approximately what we think the rotation period of Saturn is. There are other theories that suggest that water flows in from the ring system into the atmosphere. If that happens, it follows the magnetic field from the planet that threads the rings and will actually fly through those magnetic fields to determine whether that sort of phenomenon is going on or not.
Okay,
I'm just really excited about
it. Wow, it sounds like an exciting last few months of the Cassini mission. In the final 5 minutes of our program, I wanted to look more broadly, have your views and reactions more broadly to, President-elect Trump's direction with NASA. Now, one aspect of this is that Donald Trump, according to reports, is poised to eliminate all climate change research conducted by NASA as part of what is being called a crackdown on politicized science. This is according to Trump's senior advisor on issues relating to the space agency, the NASA's Earth Science Division set to be stripped of funding in favor of exploration of deep space. What is your reaction to that, that the examination of Earth, the funding for that would be stripped out of NASA? Bill?
Well, my first comment is that it, at least as I read the situation, Donald Trump has made a lot of statements that he's later changed his views about, in some cases totally reversed. So I think it's a little bit too soon to tell exactly what type of changes he'll make. But he has made statements that he doesn't believe in climate change, and I know there are comments out there that he wants to reduce the Earth science portion of NASA. First of all, I'd like to say that there's a lot of benefits to NASA's Earth science program that have little or nothing to do with climate change. For example, there's a lot of studies of the ocean. There's recent new techniques for studying the effects of earthquakes from space. We know a lot about the ozone hole that we didn't know because of the space program. So I think Earth science is kind of a code word for climate change, and climate change has become extremely politically charged. As a scientist, I believe that we should let the science speak for itself. And when we know what the facts are, and I think things are fairly clear concerning climate change, that then the politicians should decide what to do about it and how to deal with that. I personally don't believe that there are scientists out there with a political agenda that has to do with climate change. The ones that I know that are working in the field are truly trying to understand what's going on. And I think we need to listen to what the science is telling us before we make decisions.
Thank you. Bill Kurth, let's go to Jasper Halicus before our program ends. Your reaction to what I just said, the possibility that NASA's Earth Science Division, which has been a part of NASA for, what, nearly six decades of its existence, what that would mean in terms of understanding our planet in the context of the solar system and the galaxy.
Well, I'll echo a lot of what Bill said, in that we have no idea what's going to happen right now. There's a tremendous amount of uncertainty and a lot of fear on all sides. I think it would be a tremendous loss if we stopped observing our own Earth, which is one of the planets in our solar system. What we've seen at Mars right now is that there's tremendous value to observing for even a couple years. You start to see the difference between weather and climate. You know, weather is like there was a snowstorm last night. Climate is like last summer was hotter than the summer before it. And what we're seeing now on the Earth is that last summer was hotter than the summer before it, and the summer before that, and the summer before that, and back for 20, 30 years. If we stop making observations of that, we lose the ability to understand what's going on and to actually scientifically determine what's happening, which I'll echo Bill again and say that we should let the science determine what is actually happening, and then we can decide what to do about it.
Mm-hmm. So in the final minute here, when do you expect to learn more about NASA's future, about your individual involvement here, any shifts by this administration, Bill? Do you have any clue? Would you have your ear to the ground in any way?
I don't think too many people really know what's going on. I heard what I think was just a rumor yesterday that Trump is not going to develop his own budget for this coming year, that he's going to go with the one that's been proposed or the one that Congress comes up with. I think we just have to wait and see. I think if I were in Donald Trump's shoes, I would have a lot of uncertainties about what I was going to do, how I was going to make the changes that I've said I was going to make. And maybe when I get partway through, I would decide that, well, maybe there's some different ways of approaching problems.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much for joining us, both of you. Bill Kurth, a research scientist in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Iowa. Jasper Halicus, associate professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Iowa. Fascinating hour with both of you. We'll keep track of Cassini as it ends its final months of its mission. Bill, and I'm sure we'll be back in touch with you on that.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Jasper Halicus.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.